Okie dokie. Picking me up okay? Okay, we're going to try and not blast the other class out. I guess we kind of overdid it with the video last week. We left off last week talking about Dr. Persinger and the God Helmet. And what I would like to do is I've got another just real short 3-minute video that I would like to play because it has more of Dr. Persinger telling about his particular views on this. Okay, so I'm going to ask you to kind of remember what last week's video was about. This will help you do that, and then we'll start talking about it, okay? So I'm going to get it cranking here. Normally in my classes, you don't get to hear wolves. It's mainly crickets. That's a joke, son. Come on. That's not that bad. Yeah. That's about the same response I get. I'm feeling right at home. All right. So, let's talk about this some. First of all, let's talk about what Persinger found. If you remember in the first video, okay, can you pull some of that back from last week? Who can tell me some of the findings that these people had that were experiencing the God Helmet? Well, tell you what, but before we go any further, let's just talk about a little bit of the neurobiology here. On your left-hand side here, if you see on the green part that says temporal lobe, okay, this is the part of the brain that he's interested in, except he's interested specifically in the right temporal lobe, all right? The temporal lobes are interesting because they have a function. Actually, they've got several functions. One of the functions is in memory, all right? Some structures in that portion of the lobe are responsible for recalling information, okay? And also acquiring new information and setting it into long-term memory, all right? So there's a memory component. There's also an emotional component. It affects emotional, what we call affect, or the applying emotional context to our surroundings, all right? And then also it plays a role in processing sound, all right? Or hearing, actually, and helps us understand what we're listening to. So the temporal lobe is really complex. It has a lot of very interesting qualities to it. And when they put on this helmet here, he pumps electricity through some of these magnets, and it sets up a large electromagnetic field that when the electromagnetic field goes off, it causes the neurons in that area, the temporal lobe, to fire off signals. Now, all of your neurons operate on electrical signals. Electrical signals are generated in the cell, and they run down a long fiber that we call an axon, and it causes the release of a chemical at that axon terminal, and that chemical is released on another neuron, which then picks up the signal, will generate its own electrical signal, and the chain goes on. Okay, that's how neurons talk, is through what we call electrochemical processes. Now, I see some smart students in here. Electricity and magnetism are interrelated, aren't they? Right? You can use a magnetic field to generate an electric current. I mean, that's how generators in power plants produce electricity. Well, it turns out if you produce a large enough magnetic field, you can actually stimulate the neurons in that region to start firing off electrical signals of their own. Okay? So wherever this field is, in this case the temporal lobe, he's stimulating this particular portion of the brain on the right side. And I have personal experience, not with this particular device, but actually with when I was in graduate school, I took any research position I could to make money. I mean, I was the guinea pig. Graduate students will do anything for a buck. And I signed up for this brain mapping study where they took something called a Tesla coil. A Tesla coil basically produces a very large magnetic field. Okay? It's a super duper electromagnet. And what these guys in neurology were interested in doing was using the magnetic field to turn on parts of my cortex. And then they were looking for responses. And the electromagnetic pulse was only about 50 milliseconds, which is 51,000ths of a second long. It was faster than that. And they would put this thing, just position it. They just held it in their hand and then would turn it on and go crack, crack, crack. And I noticed something funny. I was twitching as they were turning on patches of neurons in my cortex. I found myself going, eek, eek. And as they moved it, different parts of my face would start to twitch. I get eek, and I get eek, do the Elvis, get eek, like that. And then pretty soon I was doing this. And they would move it across, and they were looking at what parts of cortex directly related to what parts of the body it controlled. Okay? I also noticed after about 5 minutes I could taste my fillings. I didn't think that was such a good thing. But they gave me a lot of money to do it, so okay. That would explain a lot of my personality at this point. I did a lot of other things, too, along the way. I won't tell you. Anyway, it's scary. But I know firsthand that these strong magnetic fields can affect your brain function. Okay? So, it is the temporal lobe, right? So when they stimulated the temporal lobe, what happened? What did some of the test subjects say they experienced? A sense of presence. Somebody was there. Some of them said, I don't recall if it was in the video last week, I've seen a couple of other videos with Persinger, but some of the subjects said they heard voices. Okay? Other people said they had this sense of euphoria. This presence was good. Some other people said it didn't feel quite so good. All right? There was this idea that somebody or something was around. All right? So that's pretty much the data at this point. A sense of presence. So what, just from what little we have heard, as far as Dr. Persinger goes, his personal position is, what is his worldview? I would say pretty safely we're talking definitely about naturalism. Now, without having a real long conversation with Dr. Persinger, I can't say absolutely, but it seems that's a pretty good bet, yeah? So naturalism says what? What's the tenet? One major tenet of naturalism. God is just a concept. And this guy knows the notes. You want to come to college? I could use you. Yeah. God's a concept, not a person. Doesn't really exist. Right? He's an idea. So what does that then presuppose? If God's a concept... What? Pardon? There is a natural cause for absolutely everything. All right? There's nothing that doesn't have a natural cause that cannot be explained via the scientific method. All right? So what is the evidence that this is Persinger's view? Well, he just said it. He thinks that there is, yeah, a biological basis for God. In other words, he's saying that God actually is a construct of what we in neurobiology like to call the wetware. You got hardware, you got software, between your ears, you got wetware. Okay? And that is simply the result of chance, and we make God up. How do you answer that? Because the data is the data. People are feeling something that isn't there. They're sensing a presence that, as far as we know, empirically, scientifically, ain't in the room with them. Okay, folks. That's true. They cannot prove he's not in the room, but...
God created us, and he created a part of our brain for him to reside in. For us to have...
Ooh. Very good. I thought it'd take us longer to get there than that. That's good. We can't prove that he's not there, but then that's one of those arguments that you kind of won't win. We're not really interested in winning an argument. By the way, remember, the whole reason we're looking at this stuff is not to win the argument. We want to win the person. So that's a good point. Is the foundation of God? Yes, exactly. He's making the wrong connection. He's defining the feeling as being God himself. There you go. Yes, exactly. There is the underlying assumption that colors the interpretation of the data, right? That's what he's interested in showing in the first place. Would we say there's bias here? Absolutely. By the way, all scientists are biased. Most experiments have some bias associated with it. Now, we try to limit it. We try to make sure it does not interfere with the collection of the data and how we interpret the data. But the fact is, scientists are humans, and you bet there's bias. So the assumption is that it is all naturalistic, that there has to be a scientific explanation for God in general. All right, Christians, how would we reinterpret the data? I think that was a very nice point you made. As, pardon? Exactly. Well, guess what? We are all biased. There is not a single purely objective person on the planet. Never has been. The only person with true objective viewpoint is God himself. Because he's not in the universe. He's not of the universe. He's outside the universe. Therefore, he knows everything about it. He made it. That's about as objective as you can get, right? So yes, absolutely. You have to recognize we are biased. He is biased. But if we're going to address this, how would we reinterpret the data? And she said it nicely earlier. Well, if there is a God, and we are built to have a relationship with him, and we are both body and spirit integrated, and I do not know how they integrate. Okay? We got no idea how the spirit interfaces with the organic. Sorry, no clue. Then does it not make sense that God has built into the hardware a receiver? The wetware. Yes, thank you, Al. Would he not have designed the wetware such that we have, well, not just a receiver, a transceiver that has an organic component to it? That seems perfectly logical to me, yes? So therefore, if you manipulate the wetware, it would be like bringing a very strong radio source to your little FM radio, your little iPod that you're listening to. Yeah? What you're doing is driving the wetware. You're driving the receiver. Now, if it's a hiss, if it's just noise, you know, you're going to assume, well, that's all there is, right? So what he ostensibly, we could argue, is doing is manipulating the receiver. he's confusing the source with the point of reception. Can he argue against that from the data? No. We can have a very reasonable metaphysical answer to his data. His assumption is God resides in the brain because, well, we make him up. It's the biochemical manifestation of God. When actually, I think it's the way we perceive God when he speaks with us, or a way, all right, a connection, an interface. I think that's perfectly reasonable. Because God made us to commune with him in our organic body, bodily form, right? When he walked in the cool of the day and spoke with Adam and Eve, they were corporeal, weren't they? He made the physical. And the physical is meant to interact with God, or was, right? Until we blew it. And we limited our ability. We cut ourselves off from God. But we were actually designed to, in the flesh, communicate with God. So there had to be some way of perceiving God. All right? No man has seen God at any time, right? So it's not really with the eyeballs, with the exception of Jesus Christ, who stooped, put on flesh, so that we could interface with him face to face. I always wondered, when we get saved, this is just pure hyperbole and conjecture and I don't know, weird stuff that scientists, well, scientists that are Christians, we get saved, does God sort of fine-tune our receiver and turn it to the right frequency so that now we commune with him? I don't know. I don't want to get too weird in the theology, but we are integrated. As I reading Randy Alcorn's book, by the way, as I mentioned last week, is very refreshing to realize that we were meant to be organic creatures. We're not meant to be wandering spirits. That's a very Gnostic view. The flesh itself that God made was very good. All right? It's okay to have a body. It's a good thing to have a body. It's not a good thing to be disembodied. Eventually, when we die, we will be, our bodies will be resurrected. So, yeah, there's supposed to be this intersection between brain and spirit. I got no problem with that. So, this is fun to think about. How would you use this to share the gospel with Dr. Persinger? If I'm Dr. Persinger, how might you, knowing a little bit about this, how might you open the door? You don't have to have the whole thing put together, you know?
Talk to him about how he seems to think that the only way to really know something, I mean, even said in the first video, is empirical. Mm-hmm. So challenge that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we could start to say, you know, that's very interesting. But, you know, outside the bounds of the universe, and the universe does have boundaries, by the way. Einstein pretty much clarified that in his general relativity. The universe itself has boundaries. That means that there's something outside space-time. That's hard to get your head around, right? If there's something outside space-time that is not contained in space-time, that would suggest infinity. Yeah? Sounds a bit like God to me. You can't empirically determine what's outside the universe, but we know that there is an outside to the universe. The universe has boundaries. It's limited. It's not infinite. They pretty much showed that in physics. So maybe another way we could say, you know, Dr. Persinger, there are limits to what we call reality, space-time continuum. Beyond that, there's something else. What it is, no clue. But is it possible that outside that there is the one you like to say only lives here? You know? Just opportunities.
You mentioned some of us have a fine-tuning frequency. Scripture calls it grace. Except for grace, none of us will trust Christ. And so, call it what you want. That's the fact of the matter.
Mm-hmm.
And say to Dr. Person, this is what you believe, but if you've got the guts, say, God, if you're there, plenty of people have got there. Show me you're there.
Yeah, well, that's for sure. That's an excellent point. That is an excellent point. You know, we often get into discussions, particularly when it comes to faith, naturalism. We want to go in and we want to prove a point. We want to win the argument. We want to beat people down with better science than they've got and prove to them they're a bunch of godless pagans. Yeah. I have heard a lot of very learned Christian men, scientists, do exactly that thing because they wanted to prove that they were right. And they basically blew off their big toes as far as being able to share the gospel effectively. I've heard them do it in lectures. I've heard them do it at church rallies. You know, this is all about gaining entrance into people's hearts and minds. And in our culture, that's an important thing to be able to do. Gain that audience like Paul did at the Areopagus. Okay? So, any other comments? Any other ways you might use this as a nice opening to talk to somebody that, you know, a lot of folks that are naturalists in their thinking really haven't thought through it very well. Right. 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 That's very good. Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's one of the things about faith. You know, we don't walk by sight or feeling in that sense. We trust, right? God makes himself known to us in many ways, and it's not always that warm, fuzzy feeling, that warm, fuzzy sense. You know, sometimes you get it. I believe God works through that, but exactly right. That's his narrow definition. This is God, it's a feeling, because that's all it really can, because it's really just chemical, biochemical. Well, I think
what you have to compare the brain activity of somebody who is actually saying yes, I'm experiencing God right now with the data from his temporal lobe experiment, say those are similar activities.
I believe that he has done that. I believe he's done it. He, I think, had over 900 people. And by the way, they have done EEG work looking at the electrical activity of the brain in people that are praying. There was a famous study done with Carmelite nuns and this order that were intense prayer warriors. And they found, high activity in these women's right hemispheres, and particularly in their temporal lobes. So can we prove that this is evidence of a creator God that wants us to communicate with him and has built a way to do it? No. There is no proving that. But at the same time, there is certain, this is certainly no evidence, no hard evidence, that it's all the wet wiring. Okay? Just remember that, that as we continue to talk about this, proof, we can reinterpret it satisfactorily, you know, it's not outside the Christian worldview.
I begin with attempting to show to him that he is operating from a naturalistic point of view.
Right.
Let him see that, you know, if you don't assume naturalism, there's no reason to see your conclusions. And even if you are a naturalist, there's no reason to not have plenty of other explanations anyway.
Right.
And to demonstrate that what you're really doing is you're taking your philosophical, theological views of naturalism, and perhaps might uncover a hatred towards God. And that's what's motivating him. That's why he's doing an experiment. That's why he's choosing something that he can try to interpret to, in his mind, disprove God.
Right.
But then also to show that in his worldview, his naturalistic worldview, he has no foundation for knowledge or anything whatsoever. He talked about the self in that video. Everything is just a matter of naturalism. Everything is just a process, a cause and effect, a matter of neurons, a matter of genes, etc. Then there's no possibility of self. There's no people. Everything is just a process.
There's no free will. Right.
So in some sense, we were talking before about how you could be a practical atheist in the way you act as a Christian, where you go on and act like the world. Well, in a lot of sense, you're required to the way God made you to think theistically at times. So we talk about knowledge, we talk about personal things, we talk about self. You really are presupposed in God. And that's, I would say, an important thing to show and say, you know, biblical worldview accounts for everything. And so your worldview is very, very, very short. In the Christian worldview, I look at your sign as your experiment and I say, okay, so you artificially cause certain areas of the brain to react the same way it does as far as an experience. And so what? There's plenty of other ways you could artificially influence the brain too, various other things. But that doesn't mean that that experience has the same cause,
right,
or that it's truly the same experience. But as a Christian, you know, you can account for all that. Your experiment doesn't affect my worldview. It doesn't affect you.
Yeah. That's right.
One other thing about, I don't have very much experience talking to people about, you know, arguing science and philosophy, some, but inevitably, you can argue for the rest of your life, and they'll argue too, and they'll probably enjoy it, you probably will too, if you're like me.
Oh, yeah. I like a good fight, you know.
But you have to, sooner or later, challenge them. And one way is to just pose a hypothetical question. If I were to convince you that God exists, that Jesus is God, would you bow the knee to him or not? Because when you ask that, that's where the rubber hits the road. And I've had several people say, no.
Yeah?
I wouldn't.
Yeah. That's very telling about human nature, isn't it? I mean, the heart is. Right.
So they, construct this reality for God.
Yeah. It's right. If you exclude God from the beginning, you don't have that responsibility, right? I think it's excellent. Yeah. Yeah, I think that's excellent. Challenges their worldview, their Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. It is. Probably not so much. The problem is this particular topic, faith and science, is just huge. There's all kinds of ways you can go with it. I decided to keep it more topical so that we can hit various areas so that you guys can have more tools to pick and choose from for what you're more comfortable with using and that type of thing. So I would love to. Actually, Phil probably has as much back, really, he probably is the guy to be teaching more of the philosophy of science and apologetics than I am. You know, I'm a bench geek. It's what I am. Yeah, that's maybe something to consider. Getting together and thinking about constructing a interesting course in that. I would love to.
As one ages,
mm-hmm.
and something like dementia,
mm-hmm. Doug asked, I know some of you couldn't hear, he said he wanted to know if, in the context of brain function, as we age, he said that he's noticed certain believers, you know, as they age and they lose brain function, that they lose, it would appear, their faith. They lose their Christian character and they sometimes just become, as he put it, vile. I mean, they just, wow, they're not the same person. If any of you have watched senile dementia, Alzheimer's, Parkinsonian dementia, or another one called Lewy body dementia, take a person and change their personality, change who they appear to be, and steal them from you. It's a brutal, brutal thing. Huntington's, Korea is another one. Degenerative brain diseases. My personal take on it is that we are integrated, spiritual, organic beings. Again, I do not know where the interface is. I do not know how God crafted that together. But it seems to me brain is the mechanism by which we interface with the world and we express ourselves to the world. If the mechanism for transmission is damaged, then the output is going to be faulty. And it's a particularly troubling case when you think about someone that has been a lifelong believer, solid, and a godly person, and you see them degenerating, spiraling down into what appears to be insanity. They may shout obscenities. You know, they may engage in behaviors that you just are just terrible, heart-wrenching to watch. But you know the person from before. I think it's entirely possible that, as in the case of a driver in a car with a steering wheel that's locked in a right turn and can go nowhere but right turns, is the person not there anymore? Well, they sit in the driver's seat. He's there, but the car can only do right-hand turns and circle because the mechanism is faulty. The mechanism is slowly degenerating. Finally, it breaks down, it smokes, it shudders. Would you say there's something wrong with the person in the seat? Not necessarily. It's a malfunction of the wetware. The ability to properly express. And by the way, the fact that sometimes we see these personality changes that are very negative, remember that we are still saved sinners. Yeah? Right? That's right. Because it's certainly 8 hours, yeah? It's His blood that covers us. It's His righteousness that God sees. But boy, we ain't got it ourselves. And if perhaps the inhibiting, which is prefrontal, by the way, we know that this part, the front part of our brains, helps us be appropriate. Yeah, Todd would know. You have a prefrontal problem. We call it disinhibition. You start saying things that aren't proper. You don't plan things. You are impulsive. You've got all kinds of problems. You know? Does that mean your soul is damaged? Does that mean that maybe Christ's blood doesn't work for you anymore? No. I think it's just a breakdown in the mechanism. Yeah. Now, there are some people that say, well, obviously, these people have been playing games all their whole life and they're still rotten sinners. And this is just them coming out. I would not presume that. Okay. But this is some questions when we start talking about brain stuff and, you know. Mm-hmm.
And I've said a number of times, just getting old and dead and physical and just ailments and what all. I think God reminds us how best to be human.
Yeah.
And I think of that scripture that says, when Jesus said, love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, all your mind.
All right. We are fearfully and wonderfully made, and we don't know how that whole thing works. But does that answer your question? Okay. A lot of conjecture and hand waving, but that's as far as I can get. Okay. Just something for you to think about. I want to give you just some tools to think, because really, this is about bringing Christ to the non-believer, and particularly those that have settled themselves in naturalism. We approach it not from so much the data. We can take the data. You can see, you can think your way through this, yeah? Not so scary. But, you know, it's about winning the person, not winning the argument. Okay. Going to move on. Are we okay with this? Anything anybody else wants to hit on that? I think this is just a ton of fun to talk about, but I'm a brain geek, so. All right. Want to switch gears a little bit. We've discussed worldviews, kind of how to think about worldview and use that as a tool. The next topic I really want to get to is the relationships, the perceived relationships between science and faith. Okay? How do they rub up against each other, so to speak? And how do we talk about them in the various contexts that they may be viewed? Okay? So there are really four major kinds of relationships. I told you I spit when I talked. thought I was going to get moved. There are four real categories of relationship between science and faith. Okay? Again, it depends on where you're coming from. What's your worldview as to how these relate? Four basic levels of interaction, and these four basic levels of interaction were proposed by a guy by the name of Ian Barber in his book, Myths, Models, and Paradigms, that he published in the early 70s. Dr. Barber was probably the first recognized researcher with the idea of looking how science and religion connect. All right, and everybody kind of looks at his work as being foundational and seminal in that discussion. So we're going to look at them, and I'm just going to introduce them briefly, and then we're going to talk a little bit about each one of these. We have conflict. We have independence, all right? Dialogue and integration. And what we have here is a continuum from antagonism at the top down to full-blown conversation and things in between. So we're going to begin by talking about the conflict model. And by the way, we're going to talk when we get to next week, we're going to begin talking about the history of the relationship of science and Christianity in particular. The popular conception is that Christianity and science have been at war forever. We're going to see that ain't so. But the conflict model here often is what rises to the surface in a lot of people's minds. Okay? In this situation, what we're going to have is a clash of worldviews. Scientific materialism, all right, which is another name for naturalism. I always like to be able to pull out big, complicated, polysyllabic definitions. If naturalism is just, you know, doesn't sound impressive enough, we call it scientific materialism. And that usually puts a few people in their places. Versus biblical literalism. All right? Now, have I stepped into it or what? Oh, we believe in a good literal interpretation of Scripture. And here I am saying that there's solid conflict. Now, what we mean by this, by the conflict model, is that one is entirely right or the other is entirely right. You can't have both. So either naturalism is right or this particular view of biblical interpretation is right. Now, when I talk about biblical literalism, there are a couple of ways of looking at it. And often, I'm going to present the one that a naturalist would present to you. Okay? So you understand the naturalist mindset. All right? Would somebody please pull up 1 Samuel 2:8 for me? And read it. Okay. What do you suppose I'm pointing to there? If we're the pillars of the earth. God says our planet is held up by big columns. Okay? The pillars of the earth. You know, there are some views of cosmology, such as the ancient Indian, where the earth is sort of this bowl-shaped thing. It sits on a giant elephant. The elephant sits on a giant turtle, and the turtle swims in the sea. All right? I would say probably we would think that's not true. Right? That's not a good literal representation of our cosmos. Yeah? Job 9:6. Somebody got that?
Who shakes the earth out of its place and its pillars tremble?
All right, more pillars. And not only that, he's turning the world upside down. All right? Psalm 79:3. More pillars. If you got it, read it. Nope. I must have pulled a boo-boo. I must have copied the wrong one. Let's scratch that. Isaiah 11:12. I hope the rest of these are on the beam. I'm going to be real embarrassed. Yeah, I screwed up. Sorry. Isaiah 11:12. Does this sound any better? Somebody got it? Hope this one works. Ah, thank you. Here we go. The earth is flat and square. All right. Next one. Who's got the Ezekiel verse?
And you, O son of man, thus says the Lord God to the land of Israel, an end. Now, the end has come upon the four corners of the land.
All right. Another square country. Revelation 7:1.
After this, I saw four angels standing at the four corners of the earth.
Okay. You get the idea that someone with a naturalist bent, with an unregenerate mind, would look at descriptions of the world like this and say, this is a book of fairy tales. Apparently the earth is square, or at least it's a cube. You know? You got four sides. There are only four winds, by the way. So if you're going northwest on a sailing ship, you're in trouble. Okay? We have other verses that talk about trees clapping their hands, waters clapping their hands, valleys crying out for joy. You can kind of see, maybe, in the naturalist mindset, the unregenerate heart, and of course a total lack of exegesis. These were not meant literally, but in many people's minds, these two realms are completely opposite. Either you believe that silly superstition, or you believe science. All right? I don't know where you are on the topic, but I really think we put men on the moon. I don't know if that thing. Because we could do it, because we know that certain laws apply and we could do that, but
totally different kind of conflict. The earth is billions of years old.
Mm-hmm.
Scripture says God created it, didn't evolve, it was billions of years old. Does that fall into this conflict? It's not the same thing as what you described.
No, but I think people could use it as a conflict. I think they could, yeah, absolutely, and they do. They do. Now, there are various takes on that, and I do know a lot of good, solid Christian people think the earth is old, you know. And that's a discussion for another time, but the idea, the presupposition that either you believe the Word of God or you believe science, it's an either-or prospect, okay. And when we talk about the history of science and faith, we'll see how this kind of came about. Okay, but this is one mindset you got to know is out there. That there's nothing in the Bible you can really trust. And it's one or the other. Okay? So, and we'll see it's called the warfare model a little bit later. The second type of interrelationship between science and faith is independence. And in this viewpoint, what we find is that we have two areas of knowledge that are completely separate, one from another. Okay, they are truly independent. They use separate languages. All right, science uses the language of the measurable, the natural, all right, the material. We talk about faith, we're talking about things that are not measurable, things that are intangible, concepts, the abstract. That's the viewpoint with regard to independence. However, because they are two separate domains, and people that hold this particular viewpoint with regard to the relationship, they don't see conflict. They don't see warfare. They say, just two different ways of knowing about the world. Okay? There is no overlap, so therefore there is no conflict. separate, but equal. Okay? Probably one of the best proponents, most articulate proponents of this, was somebody who came up with the idea of what's called noma, or the non-overlapping magisteria. I just love that. Doesn't that sound smart? Let me talk to you about the non-overlapping magisteria. That just makes you sound smart. That's why I went into science, because I'm not really all that smart, but if you learn a few big words, people get impressed fast. You know, it's either that or their eyes glaze over. You can either be the life of the party or kill it like that, just depending. Okay. This is by a fellow by the name of Stephen Jay Gould, a brilliant biologist, an evolutionist, pretty much a naturalist, really, a scientific materialist. I have great respect for Stephen Jay Gould. He died quite a while ago. I actually got a chance to hear him speak once. And just a brilliant, funny guy, was truly a naturalist, but he was not so much at war with faith. And I appreciated that. He was not getting in your face. He also offered an alternative view of evolution, because he was an evolutionist, but he didn't think evolution occurred the way the Darwinians said. And he was always kind of out on the fringes yelling, but he was such a great thinker that people did listen to him, even if they didn't accept his particular evolutionary viewpoints. And he said the magisterium of science covers the empirical realm. Okay, again, empiricism is the scientific method that says I look at the natural world and I measure it to make sure that what I'm seeing actually agrees with what I'm thinking with regard to theory. Okay, what the universe is made of, fact, all right, and why does it work in this way, which is theory. We theorize about how things work. All right. The magisterium of religion extends over questions of ultimate meaning. All right. And moral value. Two things. These two magisteria do not overlap, nor do they encompass all inquiry. All right. So in his mind, and in most people that were looking at it this way, they say it's limited. There's stuff that these together don't cover. For example, the magisterium of art and the meaning of beauty, what we call aesthetics. Okay? Now, this is interesting. I want you to think about this for a second. They are totally separate. They are not in conflict, but neither one really informs the other. They don't have anything to say to one another. They're equal, but separate. And they don't talk. I like to call this a non-aggression pact. All right, I'll stay on my side of the line. If you stay on your side of the line, and we will just ignore each other. Okay? Now, there are some people that hold to this. People that have, I think, not thought it through carefully enough. But basically, they don't interact at all. What would you say with regard to this definition? Here. All truth is God's truth. Right? Right? But what does that assume? It assumes God. It assumes a reasonable, orderly, non-chaotic God who would not be self-contradictory. Yeah? Is this Dr. Gould's viewpoint? No. Look at his definition of the magisterium of religion. What does he confine the magisterium of religion to? Basically, yeah. Philosophy, ultimate meaning, and morals. And I think probably he would say out of that also flows ethics. But what exactly is he leaving out? He's leaving out God, yeah?
I was going to say, even those things, that he assumes that what's going on in nature has no ultimate meaning now or moral value now. I mean, as a Christian, what's going on in nature, how it interacts with that, even those more theological questions.
Don't steal my thunder, man. You're right. Yeah. And glorify him, actually. That's right. 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 It makes the philosophical foundations for science meaningless. I mean, really, the endeavor of science itself, other than being fun. Yeah. It is. It's far more exciting. Yeah. I mean, that's absolutely right. Got any? You know, there are people that hold to this, but they're not understanding the assumptions. This separates out facts that you can't separate out.
Well, from a scientific viewpoint, it holds up to some things, but not that. For example, it's pretty common that argument that the separate viewpoints, the science doesn't have anything to say about how many angels can dance on the head of a pin. That's true, because we can't measure angels. Right. We can measure religiosity. We can measure spirituality in some ways. We can measure how committed somebody is to the faith.
Mm-hmm.
And we do it all the time.
Yeah, that's true. There are some empirical ways of assessing spiritual things. All right? But, again, within the limits of what empiricism can do. Right? Okay. So.
Also, there are theists or Christians that are beyond the earth that believe this also.
Yeah?
You know, I have me in my Bible, and if it's science, or if a scientist says it, I don't trust it. I don't believe it.
Yeah? Yeah? There. Actually, that's a very interesting story, and we're going to get to that in the history. We'll see that actually, that may not have been that way. Yeah, it's a great story. It really is. We're going to spend some time with our friend Galileo, because it really blows a lot of these relationship models out of the water. So, all right. Third one is dialogue. And in this case, we've got border areas where there's some overlap. Maybe where one can talk to the other, okay? Some things like, why is there something rather than nothing? Where we can link the empirical and the spiritual with a philosophical hitch, so to speak, okay? Is design of the natural world detectable? All right. What in the world is time? Where does it come from? We know that it has a beginning, and we're going to assume maybe if it has a beginning, it might have an end. Physicists argue about this. All right. This leads us into bigger questions. Come on. There we go. And lastly, integration. All right. With integration, we have a full dialogue, a full conversation where science can meet faith and say, what do you think about this? And we're looking at the same thing. What's your take on it? And there are a couple of ways that science and faith work in the integration model. The first is what we call natural theology, where we look for the evidence of the builder, the evidence of the creator in the natural. So that's natural theology. What does nature tell us about the maker? And this is very prominent in the current intelligent design movement, where we look at the structures of things like bacterial flagella, the little tails that drive bacteria through the water that require an enormous amount of coordination and organization to function. You take one protein out of that little molecular engine that drives a bacterium out of 35 or 40 proteins that work together in concert, and your bacterium doesn't go anywhere. All right? The argument being that if it occurred purely by naturalistic mechanisms, pure randomness, that all this order in what we see around us would come out of chaos. So, natural theology says, look at the creation to understand the Creator. All right? The flip side of that, all right, is the natural theology. Excuse me, it's first and the second is the theology of nature, where we interpret what we see in the world around us based on the knowledge that there is a Creator. In other words, based on God's attributes, what can we expect to see in the world around us? All right, it's an exploration of nature with an expectation of understanding it through God's eyes. All right? Does that make sense? So we start with God and look at creation. The first one, natural theology, says we look at nature and see how that reflects the Creator. All right? Interesting thing about theology of nature is that when we talk about the anthropic principle, and we will get to that probably in the last lecture, the anthropic principle basically says that it looks like the entire universe was organized in such a way as to support human life. Anthropic means pertaining to man. That it looks like everything was organized at the minute of creation and then on to support life on this little blue marble that's really very, very tiny in proportion to the rest of known space. All right? What does this say about the Creator God? It says He made a really, really big playpen for us. You know? He cared about us that much to organize the universe so we could be in it and have a relationship with Him. And that's what this particular viewpoint is. So the reason I bring these up is that you're going to encounter people that are operating with these paradigms in mind. And depending on who they are, all right, You want to understand where they're coming from, particularly in the first two. With people like Dawkins and Hitchens and Sam Harris, the guys I like to call the evangelical atheists, I've always wanted to say that to their face just to see what would happen. They are definitely of the first paradigm, the conflict model. Okay? Other than the Spirit of God working on their hearts, your arguments probably aren't going to get very far. You've got to know when to let the Spirit work and when to move away. But it's good to know these relationships. I think we are out of time, yeah? Am I out of time? I'm sorry. I apologize. I didn't mean to keep you over. A lot of this stuff, folks, is just to give you big context so that you know what people are thinking. You ask a few good questions and you know where they're coming from. Okay? Week after next, we're going to pick up with the history of science and faith, and we're going to see some of the roots of the conflict model. And we'll talk about Galileo and see that things are not always as they seem. Some real myths. And what you learned in school, for those of you that went to public school, probably ain't true at all. Yeah, you've been lied to a lot. Okay? Thank you.